Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to Thursday's edition of the Woman's Hour podcast. Good morning. Last week, Kim Cattrall talked about the impact of her insomnia, and lots of you have told us you've suffered in similar ways. How big a problem is sleeplessness, and how can you get a good night's rest? Diary of a Hounslow Girl, a new play written and performed by Amreen Razia. And Nursing the Nurses in the centenary year of the Royal College, who looks after them? Now, there are, according to the comedian Susan Kalman, a number of things you should never say to someone who's feeling down. Pull yourself together. Or it could be worse. Smile, it might never happen. What have you got to be miserable about? Or cheer up, love, which is the title of her book, subtitled Adventures in Depression with the Crab of Hate. Susan, who is the Crab of Hate?
The Crab of Hate is my way of trying to describe my depression to people who perhaps haven't had depression. The Crab of Hate is a crab that crawls up my back, grabs hold of my earlobes and whispers gently in my ear that I'm terrible and awful. And it seems a more appropriate description than Churchill's black dog, because my black dog doesn't sit outside my house. My Crab of Hate is always on my shoulders, and it's a case of, can I hear him or have I silenced him for a while? So it's my way of simplifying my depression so that it's a bit easier to kind of understand.
How do you know what's happening to you is depression and not just feeling a bit sad or a bit low for a while?
I think there's a number of different ways you know you're depressed as opposed to just a bit sad about something. One is the length of time that you feel it. Because my periods of depression, I talk in the book about, I measure them by how many box sets I can get through. The West Wing is 7 seasons. That's depression if you're stuck in your house watching the West Wing. But it's also the depth of the feeling that you have, that you feel so low and lonely and just despondent. So depression is a curious thing, and it's not one thing. This is the problem. Because depression can be something that lasts a weekend or it can last 30 years. And it's only really by talking about all of our different types of depression, I think people can say, oh, I've had that, maybe I was depressed, rather than just feeling a bit down.
What's the root of your apparent self-loathing, which seemed to start when you were very young?
I don't really know. When you read the book, it becomes clear that I really don't like myself particularly. I do now. I'm getting better. But I've never thought I was any good or attractive or anything, really. And I don't know. I've just always felt this way. It's certainly my depression. Some people get depression later on in life. Mine's just always been here. And the book is talking about the past 42 years of trying to cope with it.
What effect did it have on you in your teenage years? I mean, you write about cutting yourself. You use the word cut.
Yes.
You don't call it self-harm. Why not?
I think what I'm trying to do is, when you talk about self-harming, it almost sounds quite nice. You know, you're self-harming. Cutting is a much more appropriate term for what I did, because it was an angry thing to do to myself. So using that term, it's jarring, and I mean, I don't mean to upset anybody, but it's honest. It's what I did. I cut myself. I didn't self-harm. I cut myself. And I think it's important to be honest. It's difficult to be honest, but it's important to be honest about how bad I felt in my teenage years. And I felt really very bad.
You did try to kill yourself.
I did. And it's a time in my life which is difficult. But again, I want people to know this is an honest book, you know.
How did your family deal with it?
They were fantastic. I was obviously very depressed, and they have continued to be fantastic and supportive in everything that I've done. And my family are not the reason for my depression. They're wonderful people. My upbringing was beautiful, but I'm just a depressed person. And that's one of the things, though, about depression. You don't need to have a reason to be depressed. You know, sometimes people say, what have you got to be depressed about? And you go, nothing. I've got a lovely life, I've got a job I love, I've got a house, but I'm still depressed. And that's the thing. There doesn't necessarily need to be a cause of why you feel the way you feel. And part of feeling better about depression is saying, oh, well, I am depressed. And yes, there's no particular reason, but it's there.
Now, your first choice of profession was as a corporate lawyer.
Yes.
Why did you go in that direction, which I don't think helped your state of mind?
No, it didn't help my state of mind. In 1992, when I left school, if I'd said I want to be a stand-up comedian, that wouldn't have gone down very well. I mean, partly because comedy, it had fallen out of favour on television. There were no comedy clubs in Glasgow, really. So I got good grades and thought, I'll go and be a lawyer. I look quite good on the television. University for 5 years, trained for 2 years, lawyer for 7 years. And I love the law. But I found the atmosphere of being a lawyer quite restrictive. And if anything I've learnt through my years is keeping things inside is not the best way to deal with depression. Trying to normalise it. I hurt my shoulder the other day. And I can say to you, I hurt my shoulder the other day. And there's no intake of breath. When you say to someone, I've got depression, it's like you have to sit everyone down and make an announcement about it. And actually, it's just the same as hurting my shoulder. It's just part of who I am. And so being a lawyer didn't work out. So I resigned and became a stand-up comedian.
But why did comedy seem like a good idea for somebody who has depression? I mean, I've been wondering, when you're in a really low state, the crab is there,
yes,
pinching at your ears, how do you go out there and perform?
You become a slightly different person. From reading the book, you might know now I'm quite a shy person, I'm quite introverted, but I can become a different person on stage. And also, my self-esteem is very low. And so when people like what I do, it gives me an artificial boost, which does help. My lovely wife once said to me, am I not enough for you? And sadly, I like having people laughing and applauding. So I got the boost from audiences. But also what I found was I could have an opinion. I could say things. And I've never had that power before. And I think having the power to express how you feel, whether it be anger or sadness, is a wonderful thing. I didn't talk for many years about how I felt because I was frightened. But now I can.
You've never made any bones about your sexuality. I have to say, I did laugh when you said a journalist asked you once, what's it like being a female lesbian comedian?
Yes.
Is that true, or
yes,
did you make that up?
No. It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And it was just because, do you know what I think it is? It's so, people are so used to saying female comedian instead of comedian, that I think he was just putting female in front of everything without realising what he was saying. Because I'm often introduced as female comic instead of just comic. And again, this is the joy of being a comedian. I'm a comic. That's what I am. I'm the same as my male colleagues. But I think he was so used to saying female in front of everything, just so everyone was clear what I was, that he said female lesbian, which was the wrong thing to say.
Now, you've had various forms of therapy, including the one who asked you to draw the way you felt.
Yes.
What happened there?
Well, the thing is about therapy is sometimes if therapy doesn't work, people get very despondent. And the key is that it's not necessarily you. It might be the wrong therapist. So this particular therapist was trying to draw me out and said, draw how you're feeling. Now, I felt patronised. I just felt childlike. And so I drew a picture of a cat sitting beside a duck because that's all I could draw. And she said, oh, well, the cat represents your sense of loneliness and the, you know, and tried to analyse it when actually I was just making it up as I went along. And I did find therapy in the end, which was very helpful. It took 20 years to find the right therapist for
what
me.
What kind of therapy was
CBT
helpful?
Therapy. Because what I'm trying to do is change the triggers in my head that spark a period of depression and notice the signs and deal with the depression before it becomes a big issue. So CBT was things like accepting a compliment. I find that horrific. So I have to accept compliments now and go, thank you, instead of saying, No, you're right. I'm rubbish. So CBT is about trying to trick my brain into thinking I'm worth something.
Just to go back to the cat and the dog. Yeah. I know you love cats.
Yes, I do.
I see you on Twitter going on about your cats a lot. What did the duck represent?
The duck represented who I wanted to be in life, or something, an individual, something like that. I mean, it was just nonsense. It was nonsense. And I mean, in the book, I talk about a series of therapists, but it didn't go, a therapist who laughed at the way I dressed, you know. But you just have to find the right therapist to help you talk.
Now, you married your partner.
When I did.
You were allowed to.
Mm-hmm. I was allowed.
How does she deal with your obvious dislike of spontaneity?
It's difficult for her. One of the things that I have to do is control everything so I don't get worried. And she's a very spontaneous human being. So occasionally we're spontaneous and it always goes wrong. A trip to the Paris sewers, which was terrible. She was allowed to choose dinner in Venice and we wandered around for 3 hours and I started crying. She is as saintly a human being as I can imagine, because it's not easy to live with someone who hates themselves as much as I do. So
The sewers. Why did you choose to be spontaneous? I mean, you could have gone up the Eiffel Tower, you could have gone to Sacre
Bleu. Somebody on Twitter
Why the sewers?
Said it would be a good idea. And I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I thought it'd be like Phantom of the Opera. You know, I thought there'd be candles and boat rides and opera and things. And it's just the sewage system, Jen. It's just the sewage system. It's just walking around pits of feces. It was not a romantic... It was our honeymoon, essentially. It was not romantic at all.
I had to cover my face
with a cardigan because I thought I was going to be sick on myself. But since that point, my wife has let me plan everything in our lives to within an inch of our lives, and then nothing like that can ever happen again.
Now, the other thing that surprised me was that Marlene Dietrich was a help. How?
Absolutely. Well, when I was growing up, my granny looked after me. We used to watch Greta Garbo and Marlene Dietrich films, and I wanted to be like Marlene Dietrich, but I never thought I could. And my appearance has always been a problem. I'm short and stocky and not tall and thin, and I thought I could never be like Marlene Dietrich. And I went to Berlin and saw an exhibition of her costumes. And Marlene was 5'7". She wasn't a tiny woman. And she was just had such a magnificent sense of style. And after that point, I thought, you know, Marlene wouldn't sit in her house worrying. She would just go out. So I started... Essentially, I want to dress like Margaret Rutherford. This is the problem, with a tweed cape. And I started buying tweed and wearing tweed and waistcoats and just saying, you know what, this is what I look like, this is what I like. And that was a big change, saying, actually, maybe I'm not horrific looking.
You're not. You look great.
See, I can take a compliment.
Yeah.
I can take a compliment.
Say thank you, Jenny,
for that compliment. Yes.
Susan Garman, lovely to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. And just a reminder that the book is called Cheer Up, Love, Adventures in Depression with the Crab of Hate. Who wasn't here this morning, was he?
No.
He is a he, is he?
He is a he.
Yeah.
He's not here just now.
Good. Susan, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, if you were listening to the programme last Friday, you'll have heard Kim Cattrall talking about the insomnia, which affected her so badly she had to pull out of a play in which she was due to star Linda at the Royal Court in London. She was so exhausted, it made her ill.
It seemed like a small matter at first. Too much tea. Another stage of menopause. Looking back, I can only remember thinking it would right itself. I would catch up. I would make up on Sunday. I would nap during lunch. No. Tonight, I'd be tired enough to let go. Give in, surrender, succumb. Tonight, this very night, I would sleep. But that night, I didn't sleep. And I didn't sleep the next night either. Or the night after that. London Diary. I think I'm losing the ability to think clearly. Words are harder to remember without sleep. I can't grasp, hold on to ideas, thoughts, even tasks. They're slipping away from me. Since I got here and I can't sleep, I don't remember. Am I losing myself or just letting go? Is this Dad's dementia? How overly dramatic and indulgent writing this feels right now.
Well, Kim is clearly not alone. We had lots of emails from you, all suffering in similar ways.
My insomnia has been going on for 30 years. If I'm having a no-sleep night, I might only get an hour. And if I'm having a sleep night, I might get 5 or 6 hours. It just affects absolutely everything. You just can't function the next day. You get a bit dizzy. It's difficult sometimes to verbalise words. You feel that sometimes your memory's going a bit. I know with me that it's all in my head. If I've got something important the next day, it could be something to do with work. Anything which requires me to be on top form, that's almost a prerequisite for not going to sleep. It definitely has affected my work and work progression. I have only ever been able to work part-time. Not the stress of the job, but the stress of me thinking the night before, I've got to get to sleep.
I'm a single parent to 3 grandsons. I seem to start off with insomnia when the youngest one, who's only a few months old, used to make this noise when he was breathing. And I think because we slept in the same room, I was very much aware of his breathing and staying alert in order to be able to help him. And I think I've got into the groove of that and can't get out of it. In general, I get 4 hours sleep a night. There comes a point in the day, and it's just before the school run, when I begin to feel totally, totally exhausted. And I would give anything to go to sleep right at that moment. It could be 11 o'clock when the oldest one comes in. And once he's in, I need some time alone to just sort of step down from the day. So it might be 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock before I'm going to bed. And I'm always up at 6:30, no matter what has gone on. It's really difficult because you lose the power to think, to concentrate. Your mind just won't do it. It's just sitting there going, blah.
My insomnia really started around the time of the menopause. There was stress at work, elderly parents, difficulties at home. And I think that combined with hormone changes created this perfect storm for insomnia. I can get to sleep, but the trouble was I'd wake up in the night and then I just couldn't go back to sleep. And I was ending up having often maybe only 3 or 4 hours sleep a night. When I admitted that I had insomnia, so many people admitted to me. It's sort of like a secret that people keep.
So why is insomnia such a common problem? And if you do suffer, how can you get a decent night's sleep? Well, Franco Capuccio is Professor of Cardiovascular Medicine and Epidemiology at Warwick University, where he heads the Sleep Health and Society Programme and joins us from there. Franco, how common is this kind of persistent insomnia?
Good morning, Jenny. Insomnia is divided into types. One we most of us may have suffered once in a life, and this is the short-term insomnia. And about 30% in a lifetime do suffer that. However, what we've heard about is a chronic insomnia, insomnia that persists for years and may affect your life. And that is as common as up to 10%. It depends very much on how we measure that. Because insomnia is characterized by self-reporting of quality of sleep, which is impaired, as well as quantity of sleep. And it's quite complex to address the issue.
Now, Kim and a number of other women began to associate it perhaps with the menopause. To what extent does it occur at certain times of your life?
Well, I think definitely during the life course, we have a change in our needs to sleep, and the functions vary from children to young adults. And then there are transitions in our lives that tend to act as triggers. They may trigger what we can call a short-term insomnia. I'll just give you some examples, you know, marriage, cohabitation, becoming a parent for young children, caregiving or facing a loss, or worries. All these things are triggers for short-term insomnia. In general, those things resolve themselves with the resolution of the trigger. However, sometimes they are prolonged and they self-sustain themselves. And the cases we've heard are definitely all within the chronic dimension of insomnia.
What should be investigated if you can't sleep and it goes on? And maybe there might be an underlying condition?
Yes, obviously there is always an underlying condition that will trigger a chronic insomnia. Now, we do have implications with psychological factors might start you dragging into insomnia, but there will also be, and that's what we study more often here at Warwick, is the external factors of our lifestyle and the pressures of our environment that may facilitate the triggering of insomnia. In other words, the need to negotiate your sleeping time for as a commodity to pack up other things in life. We think that could be an additional problem that will lead to people reducing the amount and the quality they devote to sleep, and therefore spiraling into the inability to sleep. And I just want to remind everyone that sleep is a fundamental function for life, like a heart beating. Without a sleep, we have death. So in a sense, it's not surprising that when we reduce the quantity of sleep and also we have a bad quality of sleep, then we develop ill health.
What sort of damage, then, can it do to your health in the long term? I mean, obviously, all of these people are sleeping a little bit. They may only be having an hour or 2 hours a night, which is not going to kill them. They're not sleeping at all. But what happens in the long term?
Yes, and that's what the issue is of recent research, is clarifying the difference between the acute effects of sleep deprivation or bad quality sleep and the chronic insomnia. We have heard already in the cases that the lack of sleep will lead to a lot of failures in the functions. Sleeping helps to consolidate your memory, to improve your alertness, to regulate your mood, to improve your performance, your ability to articulate thoughts. We heard some of the listeners reporting that. But not only that, I think sleep also regulates not just brain functions, but the whole body functions. I'll give you some examples. Lack of sleep will lead to obesity because the fat cells will not consume energy and glucose as much as if you sleep longer. So will lead to or will contribute to the development of obesity. We have an increased death from cardiovascular disease, strokes, and heart attacks. Blood pressure goes up if we don't sleep much. But even we are unable to fight infections because our immune system is affected. So I think sleep is an absolute important regulator of our functions. So I think we're now revealing the long-term consequences of not sleeping enough, let's say less than 5 hours per night on a regular basis. That would be already a marker of problems lying ahead.
How helpful are prescribed medications?
Well, I think we need to differentiate what is the clinical case of severe chronic insomnia. We might have heard Kim being one of them, for instance, that sought specialist advice. And within that, there would be different treatments, whether psychological treatments. We've heard CBT in a previous example with depression. There are cases CBT in the control of sleep that could be quite effective. In terms of pharmacological treatment, the main class of drugs they use are the hypnotics, the pills that put you asleep, that prolong your sleep. I have to say that there is a huge abuse or overuse of hypnotics in conditions that would not require them. And in fact, long-term studies do clearly indicate that out of people with insomnia, those who make regular use of hypnotics have a premature mortality.
Some people have told us, Franco, that they've been tempted to buy them on the internet. I presume you're going to say no, no, no to that.
I'm horrified, but I'm horrified for this as well as for other things that are available on the internet. This is a much wider issue, that you can get anything you like from the internet. I would just discourage anyone from using hypnotics. Hypnotics will act on your brain. Will act on your brain on a regular basis, and with time, they will desensitize your brain for responding to them. So you get what we call an adaptation with less effect. But more or less, the long-term lifetime use leads to premature mortality. And if we remove that, insomnia on its own will not kill you. But we'll make a miserable life, but we'll not kill you.
Can you make up for lost sleep? Can you have a lie-in on a Sunday and catch up or not?
Yes, you can catch up on what we call the acute effects of sleep deprivation. In other words, the one that you and me have felt many, many times. We have a night out, being... the alertness is down, your ability to perform is reduced. If you have a catch-up sleep, you may recover some of those effects. However, the chronic, subtle, long-term effects on your cardiovascular system, on your metabolic system, even on your brain system, will not be recovered by the catch-up sleep.
What simple things can help? I mean, I'm thinking of things like having your own room rather than being with a partner who might snore, having the radio on at night, making sure you've had plenty of exercise during the day.
Yes, that's what we call the lifestyle. I think we do believe very much that to facilitate somebody going into sleep, for the majority of people, recognizing there would be a small proportion suffering from chronic severe insomnia, for the majority of us, we need to start learning how to create a soothing environment in our bedroom. The bedroom is for sleep only. So it's not our workplace. So no screens, dim lights, a soothing environment. Yes, if you like a bit of music, it's fine. If you like to read a book, read a book. And obviously, any physical activity closer to the time you go to bed will be counterproductive. So a strenuous exercise before going to bed, in other words, going to the gym at 11 o'clock at night before going to bed is a bad thing. It will prolong the ability for you to fall asleep. It will activate your catecholamines, your alert hormones. So those, but I want to stress that also the environment around us is very important. We need to really make sure we don't live in a noisy environment, that light pollution at night is something that makes people awake. The fact that, for instance, if we do shift work, sometimes we are pushed to do shifts where we're against our biological clock. So it is a complex lifestyle environmental issue.
Professor Franco Capuccio, thank you very much indeed for being with us. And if you missed Kim Cattrall's programme in which she described how insomnia came to dominate her, you can hear it by obviously going to the website bbc.co.uk/womanshour. Now, still to come in today's programme, Nursing the Nurses in the centenary year of the Royal College, who looks after them? A new play has opened this week at the Oval House in South London called Diary of a Hounslow Girl. It's written and performed by Ambreen Razia and will tour the country after it's been seen in the capital. It tells the story of Shahida, who's 16, a Muslim who lives with her mother and her older sister.
I suppose I should start from the beginning. You don't need to know my name because it don't matter, innit? But my mum says I was born at 8 pounds and 9 ounces and I was a caesarean, which meant they had to pull me out of one of them suction hoovers because, like, I weren't ready to come out. I was rushed, innit? You know, my sister was getting married. You know what she asked me? She asked me if I thought she should do the traditional thing and have 9 parts to her wedding. I was like, Aisha, are you dumb? Bruv, the only thing you're doing is giving Tariq 9 chances to leave you, and Gusum Sir, I don't think he loves you that much. Not like my Aaron loves me. Yeah, when I saw Miss Middleton at Hounslow East, she said that he was trouble, but I didn't care. I mean, I liked him from the second I saw him. I mean, I ain't dumb. Like, I'm smart enough to know that I don't really know anything. And you know what? I think that might get me through.
Ambreen, what is a Hounslow girl?
So, a Hounslow girl has become another stereotypical categorising name for a young person, just like an Essex girl and a Chelsea girl. A Hounslow girl has been given to a young British Muslim girl who wears a hijab, has big hoop earrings and says in it a lot.
What inspired you to create her?
I suppose it was working with young people between the ages of 12 to 16 and also just some of the experiences that I've been through in my own life and some of my friends went through, and having been to school with young British Muslim women who are having to balance their two coexisting worlds, and I really wanted to bring a character to the forefront of our stages and just who's young British Muslim, who's bold, inquisitive and questions a lot.
So how much have you is in this character?
So it's based upon some of my experiences that I've, some of the characters I've met, for example, aunties at weddings, the imam at the mosque. So some of the characters are based upon people that I know. However, it is based upon some of my school friends mainly, who I went to school with.
And what did they think about you putting them into a play?
Well, they haven't seen it. So
yet.
I mean, they haven't seen it personally, but last year when I did perform it at Oval House, there were three young Muslim girls who were sat in the audience wearing hijabs, and I did get very scared when I came on, because I was like, what are they going to think? And actually they were really, really pleased, and they said it's lovely to see a character make all the mistakes for you and unravel in front of you.
What inspired the scene when her boyfriend asks her to take off her hijab and show him her hair for the first time?
So that was based upon a friend I had at school who was seeing a boy who wasn't Muslim, and I remember come 3:30 at school, we'd be in the girls' toilets, and she would whip off her hijab and we'd have a little laugh about it, and then she'd go and meet him after school, and when we asked her about it, we asked whether he had any influence on her in terms of taking it off and, you know, putting it back on, taking it off, putting it back on. But she said that it wasn't. She said it was fully her decision, but we thought otherwise. We thought that maybe he kind of influenced her to do it.
You don't wear it.
I don't wear it, no.
What sort of family influenced you to not have to be traditional in that way?
I come from a, you know, like, I do come from a single parent family, and my mum has always encouraged me to, you know, to do whatever I wanted, you know, acting, writing. My grandmother, however, was a little bit weary about it, because it's not necessarily a secure profession. And I suppose with second generation Muslims, when they did come over to this country, it was all about security and finding a career and a job in which, you know, can get you a house, you can be happily married in, and you can get on with life in a very secure way. And acting doesn't do that.
And what about the way you look? What would your grandmother... I mean, you do have the big ring earrings, actually, but no hijab.
No hijab.
And your shoulders are uncovered as well.
Yeah.
What would your granny's response to that have been?
Well, she's okay with it. I mean, now she is.
Now she is.
Initially, I remember once I went out in a little play suit, and she was like, you know, aren't you going to put some tights on or something? But I think I'm very blessed to have a grandmother like her, who actually understands that we do live in London and we do have to assimilate into London life. And we are going to, you know, be kind of influenced by fashion and trends here. So, yeah, I was very lucky, and she's okay with it.
There is one line that keeps cropping up in your play, which is very striking, where people say, you may be British, but you'll never be English.
Yeah.
Why is that so significant?
Well, the British... It's when you have I spoke to some young women about it. That's where the line came from. I spoke to some young women and asked them whether they were proud of their British identity, mainly young women whose families come from other cultural backgrounds. Some of them said no, and some of them said, I don't know what that is. So for me, it was kind of... sometimes it's difficult to get the balance between two of, you know, understanding that you are a British citizen, but you'll never be English. You must hold on to those traditional values. And when I asked them, what is an English girl to you? One of the girls said, a chavvy girl who stands outside McDonald's, who is Caucasian. And I was like, okay. I said, well, and they said, we don't want to be like that. And it was really interesting. And it feels like something that was embedded in her. So that's where that line came from. And that's where the confusion comes.
Now, people might have seen you in the BBC Three play, Murdered by My Boyfriend. Why were you keen to take part in a play about what are known as honour killings, an unfortunate title, but that's what they're known as?
Yeah, I suppose it's something that I'm incredibly I don't want to say the word passionate, but I feel like a lot of awareness needs to be raised about that. It's tragic what happens. I mean, there are young women who essentially like balancing their two coexisting worlds, who want to have boyfriends, who want to do what every other 16-year-old wants to do, but they can't because of all that pressure that's on them. That's something that I really, really wanted to be a part of. And just to kind of raise the awareness and create a dialogue around it, because I feel like there hasn't been a dialogue around it, and it happens so sort of underground as well. And when it does happen, it's almost like business transactions that happen at that, like, very, very quickly. And it kind of just gets swept under the carpet.
Amreen Rosia, thank you very much indeed for being with us. The very best of luck with Diary of a Hounslow Girl at the Oval House at the moment and off around the country.
Yeah.
Thank you. Now, every day this week, we've been discussing nursing in this, the centenary year of the Royal College. When we're ill, we rely on them to take care of us, but who looks after them if they suffer from the physical and emotional problems that can occur as a result of what can be a very demanding job? Well, Amanda Cheesley is the RCN's professional lead for long-term conditions. Amanda, what's the biggest difficulty nurses face? I mean, we all know nurses who've got bad backs.
I think the combination of physical stresses and strains on your body and long shifts, which can leave you very tired, particularly if you've got little children or commitments at home. And there are significant emotional stresses on people that I think are underestimated by us as individuals, as nurses, but also by our colleagues and also our friends.
How easy is it for a nurse to come forward and say she or he has a problem, particularly if it's a mental health problem?
I think it's very difficult. I think it's difficult for the general public at the moment. Still, there is still a stigma about it. And I think if you're a nurse, there is a particular sense of both failure, because you shouldn't be suffering from a mental illness or those sort of stresses. And I think the other thing is there is a significant degree of fear that if you say that you are mentally ill, you have a depression, you're really struggling, that it could mean that you wouldn't be able to work because people would want you to be off work, quite rightly. But it also has an added fear that people worry about their registration, because obviously as a nurse you are dealing with both very vulnerable people but also people who are on medications that are potentially quite dangerous if there are errors. And so there is a real concern that if you are considered unfit for work, it might not just mean being off work sick, it might indeed mean that you might have to lose your registration and not work in a profession that you love.
We were talking about insomnia earlier, and I know most nurses work shift patterns. Mm. What effect does the shift pattern have on their health?
Quite significant for many people, because when I trained, which is quite a long time ago, we used to do a wodge of day shifts and a wodge of night shifts, and you might indeed do 3 months of nights and then days, whereas what happens now is that there isn't a regular night shift staff. You do days and you do late shifts and you do nights, and that could follow quite swiftly on from each other. So your body never gets accustomed to one shift or another, so it's very difficult sometimes to get sleep. And again, if you've got family or family commitments, people probably don't get enough sleep either. So you might go home off a shift and be doing the parenting, you know, runs from school or runs to social events or hospital appointments, or indeed taking kids to school or have a baby at home.
And how much do nurses suffer from attacks by patients or relatives? I mean, I've had one experience in hospital where I felt so sorry for the poor nurses who were on at night, because there was a woman suffering from dementia who was very difficult to deal with.
I think it's hugely underreported. I think that there are attacks on nurses on pretty much every shift in some form or another. It may be either verbal abuse, it could be pinching. You're talking about somebody with dementia, somebody might pinch you, might punch you. And it's not meant. And then there's the other end, the extreme end, is where people who are angry or distressed actually lash out. So many nurses working in accident emergency departments will experience verbal or physical abuse, particularly from
when
people who
when
are
they're drunk.
Drunk. Or people with mental illness who are really struggling to cope and are very angry, or relatives who are very angry who are hearing things they don't want to hear. So I think we definitely have improved in terms of understanding that it is unacceptable for people to be subjected to a physical attack. But I do think some of them are really underreported. So the smaller ones, the pinches, the punches, the nasty comments, those sorts of things probably aren't, you know, they're just considered to be normal part of the job.
Now, NHS England is proposing a pilot scheme for checking on nurses' health. And the Francis report said the physical and mental challenges of healthcare jobs must be recognised. How willing are trusts to offer a sympathetic ear?
I think it's very variable, Jenny. I think some trusts are willing and are actively doing things to try and support nurses who are both, you know, whistleblowing is one of the issues that people fear will have repercussions. And in some trusts, they're really making a huge effort to do something about that. I think there are definitely trusts that are doing a lot in terms of health and well-being for nurses. There is still, I think, a perception that occupational health departments are punitive rather than supportive. And you're sent because you've been off sick, or you're sent because there's been an issue, rather than somewhere that you could go and say, I'm really struggling, I need some help, please.
I suppose there's the worry as well, because we all know the NHS is short of money, that people will think the trust can't afford to pay to look after us.
And I think that is the case. I think it is another pressure on trusts who are struggling to make ends meet. But if we... as individuals don't look after ourselves, and if our organisations don't look after us in order for us to do the job, then we're going to really struggle to keep nurses in employment till the 65, 70 that they're going to need to work to.
What can the nurses do to help themselves? I mean, lots of people do shifts and have stressful jobs. It's not just nurses. What can they do?
I think we need to look after ourselves better in terms of what we try and eat. We need to push back and say we do need breaks. We need to be a bit more assertive about what we require in order to do our job better. And we need to try and make an effort to look at what we could do with our families that will at least give us a bit of exercise, a bit of health. We don't have to do it on our own, and we don't have to go to a gym. And things like mindfulness or stress management that you can do very easily when you're in a car or going home can be really helpful. I know Susan Coleman was talking about things like that, and it can be really, really helpful.
Amanda Cheesley, the Royal College of Nursing's professional lead for long-term conditions. Now, we had tons of response to my interview with Susan Coleman, who was talking about depression. Liz Johnson said, the wonderful Susan Coleman can brighten any day, even when talking about depression. Jo Robinson said, the lady who was just speaking with Jenny has explained exactly how I felt for many, many years. I'm now 70 and still have the odd day where my crab speaks to me. It's a person sitting on my right shoulder, sneering, criticising and generally putting me down. Horrible. Singing and acting helps, as it does, obviously, for Susan Coleman. And the wayward nun said, Susan Coleman, seems clear to me that your negative inner voice is a liar. In actual fact, you're actually wonderful. And Cat Williams said, Susan Coleman, loved your interview, thank you. I hope the crab stays away. Two kisses. And Simon Keane had an interesting perspective. He said, my wife has developed depression in the past few years, and I'm trying to cope with the effects it has on our relationship. I've searched the web, spoken to depression support organisations, but there's no support out there for us partners. I obviously want to support my wife as I love her very much, but coping with someone who'll spend months not really wanting to know me has a major impact on my well-being and our relationship. I know the NHS approach to depression is appalling, but partners also need support, and the charities don't cater for this at all. On sleeplessness, Eileen Clark was short but sweet. She said, try menopause and bereavement. I haven't had a full night's sleep for 10 years. And on nursing, Alwyn said this is such an important topic. It's not only nurses. Doctors too suffer severe mental health problems and there's no help whatsoever. And Jacqueline Lewis said, my mother was Chris Lancaster, known as Lanky. I was interested to hear some of your items on nursing this week, especially as my mother was lanky to her nursing colleagues and she was a nurse for more than 40 years. She died on April the 23rd, aged 85, and we'll be burying her on the 9th of May. She trained from 1948 to 52 at the Royal Kent and Sussex Tunbridge Wells and later worked for many years at Horsham Hospital as a state registered nurse and then as a well-respected ward sister. She always listened to Woman's Hour and would have loved this week's programmes. I wonder if you could find time to mention her on your programme. Just did. Tomorrow, I'll be joined by Zoe Wanamaker, Barbara Flynn and Nina Sosania to discuss Elegy. It's a new play at the Donmar Warehouse about science and the brain. What happens when one partner in a marriage has a degenerative neurological condition, can have an operation which will save their life and improve their cognitive abilities, but wipe out the memories of the marriage? Join me tomorrow, just after 10. Bye-bye.